I'm Ingrid Christiansen. I'm doing a session on two stories of Tilly Olson. I hope two stories, or maybe two stories. We'll start with one. The stories are Tell Me a Riddle and I Stand Here Ironing. I'd like to say a couple of things about Tilly Olson to start with. She's a woman who was born in 1913, which makes her, 74 now? She is not a very prolific author, and the reason that she's not very prolific is clear, in her mind at least, or at least hadn't been prolific until when she was 42, she got a grant to start hiring childcare and having her house cleaned and doing some writing. But she's a very talented writer, and she's been very sensitive on the point of women's work and on what she calls the three-part problem. I can't spot the phrase right now, but she talks about how women have to be, first of all, house people. You know, they raise children and keep houses. And then frequently they have a second set of jobs, which she has always had, which have varied from working as a temporary secretary to various sorts of work like that. So there's jobs to earn money, there's jobs at home, and then if you're an artist, there's a third thing in your life, which is that you try to do your art, which she describes herself doing on the way to work at stoplights and, you know, carpooling. And she had four daughters, and she writes a lot about mothers and daughters. She's, extremely insightful. She calls it the triple life of mothering and housewifery, of working full-time as a transcriber in the dairy equipment company and part-time as a Kelly girl typist and Western agency girl secretary. All these girl, you know, this grown woman with children. And of trying to be a writer. So she writes well about those issues. Those are kinds of things that enter into her work, and you'll see that throughout a lot of her work. She's now written a couple of novels, and she has more short stories out, but there's just not enough. For those of us who are Tilly Olson fans, we'd like to see a lot more. She's a wonderful, insightful person, and she gives her narrator or her main character, who's a woman, that same kind of insight. I always think of her main characters as being Tilly Olson because they always know so much, and I always assume Tilly Olson knows so much, wise and insightful and sensitive. So that I think you'll notice in both these stories that we'll talk about tonight. One of the stories, Tell Me a Riddle, is too long. It's actually a short story that's broken up into chapters. It's my favorite of the two, and I would love to read it to you, but it's just too long. So I'm going to read you the other as having perhaps a greater claim because it was grassy and wanted wear. Sorry about that. It sounds like a Robert Frost poem, that read you the other line. And then I'm going to tell you about Tell Me a Riddle and read you some excerpts out of it. And as I'm reading you the first one, I Stand Here Ironing, I'll comment along the way, and you're welcome to do the same. I think we'll just stop every so often and talk about what's happening. She's talking in I Stand Here Ironing about her 19-year-old daughter and about the life of that child to that time. One of the things that she highlights in this story is circumstances, how circumstances outside of our control affect so much the quality of our life. In this case, the circumstances involved poverty, involved her husband leaving her when the baby was 8 months old because he couldn't stand sharing poverty with them. It was too hard on him, the poor baby. So it's sort of a critique of society at the same time as it's a very personal story about a woman. And I think the critique of society really runs through both of these. In Tell Me a Riddle, it's a very old woman who's dying of cancer, the whole story. And that is the woman, this old wise old woman is dying of cancer. It's her critique of her society. And it's just beautifully written. It's absolute poetry throughout. I recommend it highly. That is in Tell Me a Riddle, the one about the woman dying. It's also the woman struggling with her faith. She's a Jewish woman and struggling with her faith and with what is meaningful in life, what gives life dignity and significance and meaning. And it's a very helpful story for someone of any age, I think. It's just a wonderful story. It's also about that woman and her relationship to her children and her grandchildren while she's dying. Well, we'll start with I Stand Here Ironing. And as I said, please interrupt whenever you have something you'd like to say or comment you'd like to make or a question, or even if I read too fast and you missed something. I stand here ironing, and what you asked me moves tormented back and forth with the iron. And it's a typical Tilly Olson, because there we are with a woman doing woman's work and yet doing another kind of woman's work, which is thinking about the nurturing of her children and how to make the personalities in her life come out okay. Quote, I wish you would manage the time to come in and talk with me about your daughter. I'm sure you can help me understand her. She's a youngster who needs help and whom I'm deeply interested in helping. End quote. Who needs help? Thinks the mother. Even if I came, what good would it do? You think because I am her mother, I have a key, or that in some way you could use me as a key? She has lived for 19 years. That is all that life is, there is all that life that has happened outside of me, beyond me. And when is there time to remember, to sift, to weigh, to estimate, to total? I will start there. I will start, and there will be an interruption, and I will have to gather it all together again, or I will become engulfed with all I did or did not do, with what should have been and what cannot be helped. So the woman is saying, in response to the teacher's note, saying, come in and talk to me about my daughter, your daughter, she's saying, what good would it do? I don't know. She's lived 19 years of her life out there. I don't have the key to her life. And besides, if I start thinking about her, I'll just be interrupted. And if I'm not interrupted, I'll get upset. So she's basically saying no. And then, Tilly Olson does this all the time, she just turns a corner. She was a beautiful baby. The first and only one of our five that was beautiful at birth. You do not guess how new and uneasy her tenancy and her now loveliness. You did not know her all those years. She thought she was thought homely, or see her poring over her baby pictures, making me tell her over and over how beautiful she had been, and would be, I would tell her, and was now to the seeing eyes. But the seeing eyes were few or non-existent, including mine. I nursed her. They feel that's important nowadays. I nursed all the children, but with her, with all the fierce rigidity of first motherhood, I did like the book said. Though her cries battered me to trembling, and my breasts ached with swollenness, I waited till the clock decreed. My Aunt Josie once told me when I had my first baby and was nursing her, whenever she fussed, on demand, the hip modern way to nurse. Josie sat there and tears streaming down her face, a woman about 75, telling about how when her first baby was born, 50 years ago, she had been ordered by her Lutheran German pediatrician that the proper way to nurse a baby was every 4 hours, and you would spoil them if you did anything else. And so she said she would sit beside the baby's cradle, sobbing, and the baby would be shrieking with hunger, and she would be bursting with milk, and she would obey the pediatrician. And then sometimes, just a few times, she said she disobeyed and nursed that baby. And she too talked about the effect of that later in life. So it's a very difficult sad thing to saddle a young mother with. It hurts them both so much, it batters them both so much to do that, the pain on both sides. Why do I put that first? I do not even know if it matters or if it explains anything. She was a beautiful baby. She blew shining bubbles of sound. She loved motion, loved light, loved color and music and textures. She would lie on the floor in her blue overalls, patting the surface so hard in ecstasy, her hands and feet would blur. She was a miracle to me. But when she was 8 months old, I had to leave her daytimes with a woman downstairs to whom she was no miracle at all. For I worked, or looked for work, and for Emily's father, who could no longer endure, he wrote in his goodbye note, sharing want with us. I was 19. It was the pre-relief, pre-WPA world of the Depression. I would start running as soon as I got off the streetcar, running up the stairs, the place smelling sour, and awake or asleep to startle awake. When she saw me, she would break into a clogged weeping that could not be comforted, a weeping I can yet hear. After a while, I found a job hashing at night so I could be with her days, and it was better. But it came to where I had to bring her to his family and leave her. It took a long time to raise the money for her fare back. Then she got chickenpox and I had to wait longer. When she finally came, I hardly knew her. Walking quick and nervous like her father, looking like her father, thin and dressed in a shoddy red that yellowed her skin and glared at the pockmarks. All the baby loveliness gone. She was 2. Old enough for nursery school, they said, and I did not know then what I know now. The fatigue of the long day and the laceration of group life in the kinds of nurseries that are only parking places for children. And of course, that's an issue, isn't it, now, that we all have to face who have children these days, is the long day, the parking place, the lack of love. And just that paragraph, the little short paragraph about getting off the subway and running home and tearing up the stairs to her baby, and then the baby weeping and the mother weeping. All of that pain, and that pain came not because that mother was a bad mother. It wasn't that mother's fault. And even sending the child off to the in-laws was not because she was a bad mother. Do you have any feedback or comments on it so far? Do you want to say anything? It's a pretty compelling story. It's easy to just go on. Except that it would have made no difference if I had known that it was just a parking place for children. It was the only place there was. It was the only way we could be together. The only way I could hold a job, which is still true today, of course. And even without knowing, I knew that the teacher was evil, because all these years it has curdled into my memory, the little boy hunched in the corner, her rasp, "Why aren't you outside? Because Alvin hits you? That's no reason. Go out, scaredy." I knew Emily hated it, even if she did not clutch and implore, "Don't go, Mommy," like the other children mornings. She always had a reason why we should stay home. "Mama, you look sick." "Mama, I feel sick." "Mama, the teachers aren't there today. They're sick." "Mama, there was a fire there last night." "Mama, it's a holiday today. No school. They told me." But never a direct protest, never rebellion. I think of our others in their 3-4-year-oldness, the explosions, the tempers, the denunciations, the demands, and I feel suddenly ill. I stopped the ironing. What in me demanded that goodness in her? And what was the cost to her of such goodness? The old man living in the back once said in his gentle way, "You should smile at Emily more when you look at her." What was in my face when I looked at her? I loved her. There were all the acts of love. It was only with the others I remembered what he said, so that it was the face of joy, not of care or tightness or worry, I turned to them. Too late for Emily. She does not smile easily, let alone almost always, as her brothers and sisters do. Her face is closed and sober. But when she wants, how fluid. You must have seen it in her pantomimes. You spoke of her rare gift for comedy on the stage that rouses a laughter out of the audience. So dear, they applaud and applaud and do not want to let her go. See how she gets out of her reverie for a minute and addresses the teacher. So this whole thing is really because of what the teacher asked and saying, well, you know what a gift she has. You've seen her on stage. You know how lovely she is. And to click back into that, she refers to the iron because that's what she's standing doing and that's where we started. Where does it come from, that comedy? There was none of it in her when she came back to me the second time, after I had to send her away again. She had a new daddy now to learn to love, and I think perhaps it was a better time, except when we left her alone nights, telling ourselves she was old enough. Can't you go some other time, Mommy, like tomorrow, she would ask. Will it be just a little while you'll be gone? The time we came back, the front door opened, the clock on the floor in the hall. She lay rigid, awake. It wasn't just a little while. I didn't cry. I called you a little, just three times, and then I went downstairs to open the door so you could come faster. The clock talked loud. I threw it away. It scared me what it talked. She said the clock talked loud that night. I went to the hospital to have Susan. She was delirious with the fever that comes before red meals, but she was fully conscious all the week I was gone and the week after we were home, when she could not come near the baby or me. That's a classic, kind of another set of alienating things. When a new baby comes into the family and the first child is kept away, kept at a distance, not allowed, can't hug the mother, can't hug the new baby. You know, Tilly Olson is really setting this kid up for a fall. Misery after misery. It's a litany of sorrows. It's one thing after another. In a sense, I think the weakness of the story is that it's too many one things after another. But each one is so sad, and each one communicates so clearly. And it communicates against an unspoken standard, but it's a standard that we all resonate with. And it's a standard of what's human. How people should treat each other. What's a decent thing? We know when she says what happened, like she in the story about her they're leaving their child home alone while they went out in the evening, we know that the pain of the child was too great and that they shouldn't have done that. We understand, even though Tilly didn't say, well, we made a mistake, or, well, she was just feeling babyish that night. Tilly Olson understands that we understand all these violations of the human spirit, whatever caused them. She did not get well. She stayed skeleton thin. This was after the second baby came, when she'd had that high fever and then the measles or whatever it was, the red measles. She did not get well. She stayed skeleton thin, not wanting to eat, and night after night she had nightmares. She would call for me, and I would sleepily call back, "You all right, darling? Go to sleep. It's just a dream." And if she still called, in a sterner voice, "Now go to sleep, Emily. There's nothing to hurt you." Twice, only twice, when I had to get up for Susan anyhow, I went in to sit with her. How does she remember that?
Because she feels so guilty.
Yeah. I have no memory of the number of times I got up with my children when they were little. And I think most people probably don't. You just get up with them. But she remembers, and that really shows. And she remembers the time she went, not the time she didn't go. Now, when it's too late, as if she would let me hold and comfort her like I do the others, I get up and go to her. At her moan or restless stirring, "Are you awake? Can I get you something?" And the answer is always the same, No, I'm all right. Go back to sleep, Mother. They persuaded me at the clinic to send her away to a convalescent home in the country where, quote, she can have the kind of food and care you can't manage for her, and you'll be free to concentrate on the new baby. They still send children to that place. I see pictures on the society page of sleek young women planning affairs to raise money for it, or dancing at the affairs, or decorating Easter eggs, or filling Christmas stockings for the children. They never have pictures of the children, so I do not know if they still wear those gigantic red bows and the ravaged looks on the every other Sunday when parents can come to visit unless otherwise notified, as we were notified the first 6 weeks. Oh, it is a handsome place, green lawns and tall trees and fluted flower beds. High up on the balconies of each cottage, the children stand, the girls in their red bows and white dresses, the boys in white suits and giant red ties. The parents stand below, shrieking up to be heard, and the children shriek down to be heard, and between them the invisible wall, not to be contaminated by parental germs or physical affection. There was always a tiny girl who always stood hand in hand with Emily. Her parents never came. One visit she was gone. They moved her to Rose Cottage, Emily shouted in explanation. They don't like you to love anybody here. She wrote once a week, the labored writing of a 7-year-old. I am fine. How is the baby? If I write my letter nicely, I will have a star. Love. There never was a star. We wrote every other day, letters she could never hold or keep, but only hear read once. We simply do not have room for children to keep any personal possessions, they patiently explained, when we pieced one Sunday's shrieking together to plead how much it would mean to Emily to keep her letters and cards. Cruelty, just flat out cruelty on the place on the part of this child. They didn't let parents hold the children.
That's real.
Sounds like prison. It's real in prison. Does anyone have any experience with homes?
It sounds more like a state school. What it would sound like today.
Well, there were all of those babies and orphanages that were never held for retardless, so this is.
Yeah. Well.
I lived there with Steve Green and I for his quiz children. And, well, they started out with Connie's parents to try to give them more like a mother and a father. But there were so many of them, it was pretty hard to give them all. And they were treated kind of equal or different friends. But it does happen. I know I was a nurse, so when they were sick, they used to come to the hospital. And I would, sometimes I'd even tell them by God that they had a little temperature or something, and I wouldn't keep them at night. And some of the social officials get angry at me, they're not sick. And I said, well, I'm a nurse, and they have a little temperature, and I think it's best that you rest here. And they needed that little extra rest and attention.
Well, bless you.
There's a There's a state hospital in Houston, or no, in Galveston, Texas, where the kids can go for free. But oftentimes the kids are sent, and the parents don't have the money to come. And so there's little bitty kids there by themselves, and there's a few people that can go around and do some infant stimulation.
Yeah.
Well, this one sounds as if the parents came to visit, they wouldn't let them touch their children, which seems really different. You think that they would have encouraged it, but maybe they thought it would be too hard on the children then when the mothers and fathers were gone and they were there all that week without them or that again.
But they didn't want the parents to see the conditions.
Probably didn't want it. Yeah.
I worked at a wealthy summer camp when I was in college. in New England, and there the parents were allowed to come once during the summer and no other time. They came the end of the fourth week, and then the children had four more weeks to go. And the administration of the summer camp told us how awful the children were going to be during the fifth week after the parents had been there. It was really...
That may have been the idea of this rescue, so they wouldn't get all upset with the parents.
You wonder why they would keep it, but now it goes on to say, explain a little about the difficulty of extricating this child from this place. Each visit she looked frailer. She isn't eating, they told us. They had runny eggs for breakfast or a mush with lumps, Emily said later. I'd hold it in my mouth and not swallow. Nothing ever tasted good, just when they had chicken. It took us 8 months to get her released home. And only the fact that she gained back so little of her 7 lost pounds convinced the social worker to release her. I used to try and hold and love her after she came back, but her body would stay stiff, and after a while she'd push away. She ate little. Food sickened her, and I think much of life, too. Oh, she had physical lightness and brightness, twinkling by on skates, bouncing like a ball up and down over the jump rope, skimming over the hill, but these were momentary. She fretted about her appearance, thin and dark and foreign-looking, at a time when every little girl was supposed to look as though, to look or thought she should, look a chubby blonde replica of Shirley Temple. The doorbell sometimes rang for her, but no one seemed to come and play in the house or be a best friend. Maybe that was because we moved so much. So there's another layer of problem in the family, is the moving. Too much. There was a boy she loved painfully through 2 school semesters. Months later, she told me how she had taken pennies from my purse to buy him candy. Licorice was his favorite, and I brought him some every day, but he still liked Jennifer better than me. Why, Mommy, why? The kind of question for which there is no answer. School was a worry to her. She was not glib or quick in a world where glibness and quickness were easily confused with ability to learn. To her overworked and exasperated teachers, she was an overconscientious, slow learner who was trying to catch up and was absent entirely too often. I let her be absent, and though sometimes the illness was imaginary, like what you did. How different from my now strictness about attendance for the others. I wasn't working. We had a new baby. I was home anyhow. Sometimes, after Susan grew old enough, I would keep her home from school, too, to have them all together. Mostly, Emily had asthma, and her breathing, harsh and labored, would fill the house with a curiously tranquil sound. It's odd that the mother found that sound tranquil, but it was almost as though just having the assurance that that child was there in the house, living, and we know she's living because we can hear her breathing, was comforting to the mother, because the mother had suffered through all these years too and needed more closeness with that child, had frustrations and needed her. I would bring the 2 old dresser mirrors and her boxes of collections to her bed. She would select beads and single earrings, bottle tops and shells, dried flowers and pebbles, old postcards and scraps, all sorts of oddments. Then she and Susan would play kingdom, setting up landscapes and furniture, peopling them with action. These were the only times of peaceful companionship between her and Susan. I have edged away from it, that poisonous feeling between them, that terrible balancing of hurts and needs I had to do between the two, and did so badly those earlier years. Oh, there are conflicts between the others, too, each one human, needing, demanding, hurting, taking, but only between Emily and Susan. No, Emily towards Susan, that corroding resentment. It seems so obvious on the surface, yet it is not obvious. Susan, the second child, Susan, golden and curly-haired and chubby, quick and articulate and assured, everything in appearance and manner Emily was not. Susan, not able to resist Emily's precious things, losing or sometimes clumsily breaking them. Susan telling jokes and riddles to company for applause while Emily sat silent, to say to me later, That was my riddle, Mother. I told it to Susan. Susan, who for all her 5 years difference in age, was just a year behind Emily in developing physically. We might get into some stuff about sibling rivalry and that whole thing. Sibling rivalry is worse when, I mean, it's exacerbated by a parent who's depleted, a parent who can't lavish love on everybody. And that obviously was the case here. The parent, the mother was still struggling to get a finger hold on life herself. I am glad for that slow development that widened the difference between her and her contemporaries, though she suffered over it. She was too vulnerable for that terrible world of youthful competition, of preening and parading, of constant measuring of yourself against every other, of envy. If I had that copper hair, or if I had that skin. She tormented herself enough about not looking like the others. There was enough of the unsureness, the having to be conscious of words before you speak, the constant caring. What are they thinking of me? What kind of an impression am I making? There was enough, without having it all magnified unendurably by the merciless physical drives. Ronnie is calling. He is wet and I change him. It is rare there is such a cry now. That time of motherhood is almost behind me, when the ear is not one's own, but must always be racked in listening for the child's cry, the child call. We sit for a while and I hold him. Looking out over the city spread in charcoal with its soft aisles of light. Shugley, he breathes and curls closer. I carry him back to bed, asleep. Shugley, a funny word, a family word, inherited from Emily, invented by her to say comfort. In this and other ways, she leaves her seal, I say aloud, and startle at my saying it. What do I mean? What did I start to gather together to try and make coherent? I was at the terrible growing years, war years. I do not remember them well. I was working. There were four smaller ones now. There was not time for help to be a mother and housekeeper and shopper. She had to set her seal. Mornings of crisis and near hysteria, trying to get lunches packed, hair combed, coats and shoes found, everyone to school or childcare on time, the baby ready for transportation, and always the papers scribbled on by a smaller one, the book looked at by Susan, then mislaid, the homework not done. Running out to that huge school where she was won, she was lost, she was a drop, suffering over her unpreparedness, stammering and unsure in her classes. There was so little time left at night after the kids were bedded down. She would struggle over books, always eating. It was in those years she developed her enormous appetite that is legendary in our family. And I would be ironing or preparing food for the next day or writing V-mail to Bill or attending the baby. Sometimes, to make me laugh or out of her despair, she would imitate happenings or types at school. I think I said once, why don't you do something like this in the school amateur show? One morning, she phoned me at work, hardly understandable through the weeping. Mother, I did it. I won. They gave me first prize. They clapped and clapped and wouldn't let me go. Now suddenly, she was somebody, and as imprisoned in her difference as she had been in her anonymity. She began to be asked to perform at other high schools, even in colleges, and then at city and statewide affairs. The first one we went to, I only recognized her that first moment when, thin, shy, she almost drowned herself into the curtains. And then, was this Emily? The control, the command, the convulsing and deadly clowning, the spell. And then the roaring, stamping audience, unwilling to let this rare and precious laughter out of their lives. Afterwards, they said, you ought to do something about her with a gift like that. But without money or knowing how, what does one do? We have left it all to her. And the gift has often eddied inside, clogged and clotted, as been used and growing. She is coming. She runs up the she is coming. She runs up the stairs, two at a time, with her light, graceful step, and I know she's happy tonight. Whatever it was that occasioned your call did not happen today. Aren't you ever going to finish the ironing, Mother? Whistler painted his mother in a rocker. I'd have to paint mine standing over an ironing board. This is one of her communicative nights, and she tells me everything and nothing as she fixes herself a plate of food out of the icebox. She is so lovely. Why did you want to have me come in at all? Why were you concerned? She will find her way. She starts up the stairs to bed. Don't get me up with a rest in the morning. But I thought you were having midterms. Oh, those, she comes back in and says quite lightly. In a couple of years, we'll all be Adam dead. They won't matter a bit. She has said it before. She believes it. But because I have been dredging the past, and all that compounds a human being is so heavy and meaningful in me, I cannot endure it tonight. I will never total it all. I will never come in to say, she was a child seldom smiled at. Her father left me before she was a year old. I had to work away from her first 6 years when there was work, or I sent her home to his relatives. There were years she had care she hated. She was dark and thin and foreign-looking in a world where the prestige went to blondness and curly hair and dimples. She was slow where glibness was prized. She was a child of anxious, not proud, love. We were poor and could not afford for her the soil of easy growth. I was a young mother. I was a distracted mother. There were other children pushing up and demanding. Her younger sister seemed all that she was not. There were years she did not want me to touch her. She kept too much in herself. Her life was such she had to keep too much in herself. My wisdom came too late. She has much to her, and probably little will come of it. She is a child of her age, of depression, of war, of fear. Let her be, so all that is in her will not bloom, but in how many does it? There is still enough left to live by. Only help her to know, help make it, so there is cause for her to know that she is more than this dress on the ironing board, helpless before the iron. Well, there we all are. She was a child of anxious, not proud, love. We were poor and could not afford for her the soil of easy growth. She will not let her be so all that is in her will not bloom, but in how many does it? There is still enough left to live by. I think those are the keys at the end. Any comments? Cheerful story, isn't it? Yeah.
I see that the mother is a survivor.
Uh-huh.
By a hard road, and she recognizes that in her daughter there is a survivor also. She knows that Emily will make it. There's enough left in her.
Yeah. And Emily's only 19. She had Emily when she was 19. Is Emily that far removed from all of our experience? I mean, I think the litany of sorrows is longer than almost anyone here could say, but not necessarily. And the kinds of sorrows, I mean, the kinds of sorrows that were shared with us this morning at Matins, the sorrows of all of our lives, this are do damage to our souls. Hers were these sorrows. both for the mother and the child.
Where did the gift come from? That feels more...
The talent?
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like it came out of nowhere. I mean, it sounds like it was a miracle.
Probably being with other children and finding that she went into life, there was a time where she was enjoyed by others.
And she also said that her mother, when her mother would be depressed, she would entertain her mother. Or when she would be depressed, she and her mother would do that together in the kitchen in the evening if they were somewhere. It referred to that. The clowning, that's when her mother suggested she...
She didn't realize it was a gift herself until she was...
Yeah.
I remember once hearing Henry Fonda say that he didn't like himself very well as a person, and so he liked playing the parts of other people. And I wonder if this could be in her life, that her own life was too painful, so she could act a part there.
You hear many artists talk about the not liking themselves or not liking their life or having pain, and that the art comes somehow grows out of that. They can express for all of us a kind of depth and breadth of emotion and human expression of whatever, because they've had bad things happen. So maybe it came out of her pain.
We need to stop that also. How, you know, it was one thing to help them through their life.
I know a lot of musicians that use guitar or piano as sort of a social crutch, something to hide.
People who are shy or uncomfortable with other people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, because her mother says that she's trapped in her fame the same way as she was trapped in her anonymity, and that she can only be famous once that's happened.
Is that why she didn't want her to bloom? That was what I didn't get.
I don't think she said she didn't want her to bloom. She just said she wasn't going to. She did say, help her to understand that she has more power than the dress that I'm ironing. Being pushed about. And see, that image, I think, is important. I stand here, ironing is the name of the story. It starts with ironing. We refer to ironing a couple times throughout, and then at the end we come back to ironing. And she says, help this child to understand that she's more than this dress I'm ironing, being pushed about by the iron. So the child is more than being pushed about by the forces of life, that she has some ability to be her own motivator, her own force, and not just a victim.
You know, the universal core, I think, that it touches for me as a mother is all that's incomplete, all that I don't do.
Mm-hmm.
And I have friends who haven't had children, and my sister hasn't had children. And it seems like they thought about all that their parents didn't do for them, and then when you have your own children, it seems like you think a lot about
I think you can survive an awful lot when you know that you're loved. And later on you understand that they did the best they could under the circumstances, as long as there was that love. And she had that to everything. She was never abandoned from that.
Well, except that, I don't know, the 7-year-old kid that shipped away somewhere that she doesn't like for 8 months, that kid may not have known she was loved at that point.
Later on, I think she would know.
Up until 5 is supposed to be just a really critical developmental time. Kind of when you get your self-concept. Just a lot of other developmental things happen before you're 5 years old. So it's a real tough time to be shuffled around, not being in a stable environment. Growing, just getting wrong.
it says something when the child came back, where she wouldn't let her mother hold her. She would push away. And I think she knew her mother loved her, but she wasn't going to forgive her right yet. She was sort of... And the mother needed the hugs. The mother wanted to be forgiven.
Mm-hmm. The child may have feared that she was going to be sent away again and wouldn't let anybody, didn't mind it too close to anybody.
Mm-hmm. Good point, both of those. Yeah, the child was entitled to a lot of anger at that point. And it would have been better if she could have been flat out with it. She wasn't given to anger, this child. She never got angry with her mother. And her mother, in fact, that's the point when the mother realizes, all my other children would have thrown a fit at age 3 if we had asked this of them. And that's, she said, and then she stops ironing and thinks about that. And then she feels terrible pain that this child didn't even have enough ego to complain mightily at mistreatment, or what she felt was mistreatment. I remember when I was reading a child book about babies, when I had my first baby, I read lots of books about him because I was insecure. And it said the saddest thing, whoever's book this was, said the saddest thing was when a baby no longer cried, because then the baby no longer was asking or expecting help, but just had given up. And so a healthy thing is a child who... And the book was also reassuring in saying that if a child is really crying in pain, as long as you demonstrate to the child that you're very concerned and sorry, even if you can't sort out why there's pain, like colic or whatever, if the child senses the concern, the love, so that when the child saw that mother tearing up the stairs to pick her up in that awful daycare she was in, and she could see that the mother loved her and wanted to be with her and was sorry about it, that would have covered that, bridged that gap of actually leaving the kid with indifferent care for a long period of time every day. I think each of us could probably point in ourselves to ways in which we feel our growth in our early years was hampered in some way, or was not encouraged where it should have been. We can probably point in our children to ways that we wish we could get them to flower more than they seem able to flower, or more than we seem able to do that for them. So I think this family's on a continuum that we're probably all on. You know, we all have ways in which we're less self-confident than we wish, or we didn't bloom perfectly either, did we? I mean, maybe you did. We have a little time. I would be glad to start to tell me a riddle if you'd be interested in moving on. If you'd like to stay with this one, I'd be glad to do that.
I have one question. Did you say she was a black?
Mm-mm.
No, she's not.
All right. Did you tell
them?
I thought she was.
Tilly Olson. She was raised, I think, in Nebraska. Let's see. Born in 1913, so we figured out her age. She's currently living in San Francisco. Tilly Olson has taught at Stanford University, the Massachusetts MIT, University of Massachusetts Boston, 2-year fellowship at Radcliffe, won an O. Henry Award, recently a novel, Yo Non Dio, from the 30s, and she's edited Rebecca Harding's Davis's story, Life in the Iron Mills. Olson at present has a Guggenheim Fellowship and is working on a novel about working class life in the 50s. There's a little bit. doesn't say, but they would all be in their 40s and 50s now, I would think. Right. This other story is really much more lyrical and beautiful at the end. The woman who's dying goes through a terribly alienated period during the months that she's dying, where she won't hold her grandchildren, will not bring anything close to her, fights with her husband to the point that he almost leaves, and really puts off many things. And she's reconciled and comes to peace with herself and with her theology and her philosophy of life through her granddaughter. She and her granddaughter end up, and her husband, then the three of them make a triangle for the last month or so of her life that's really beautifully described here. The first paragraph of this story, I think, is so beautifully written. It's called Tell Me a Riddle. For 47 years, they had been married. How deep back the stubborn, gnarled roots of the quarrel reached, no one could say. But only now, when tending to the needs of others no longer shackled them together, the roots swelled up visible, split the earth between them, and the tearing shook even to the children long since grown. Why now? Why now? Wailed Hannah. As if when we grew up weren't enough, said Paul. All their children are saying, why are our parents fighting now? Lenny wrote to Clara, they lived over so much together. What could possibly tear them apart? All these children's ignorance kind of about their parents. You know, our parents have to be ideal, pleasant, sweet, happily married parents now. They're our children's grandparents, you know. Do it right, for Pete's sake. You know, don't quarrel and be unpleasant and unhappy. We want sweet little old grandparents. And the couple that this is about are very strong people and very articulated and very interesting, but sweet they are not. So the question is, what root, the gnarled roots of the quarrel, how deep back they went, what could it be that tore them apart now? And then Tilly Olson's answer is, something tangible enough. Arthritic hands and such work as he got, occasional. Poverty all his life, and there was little breath left for running. He could not turn away from this desire to have the troubling of responsibility, the fretting with money, over and done with. To be free, to be carefree, where success was not measured by accumulation, and there was use for the vitality still in him. And then it starts a description of the battle going on between the couple. And the battle is whether they should sell their house and move into the haven, his lodge's haven, which is a retirement home where all your needs are met. And it's a little piece of heaven. So that's the source of the battle between them. She says, I want my own space around me, I want my own food on the table, I want my own life, and he says, I want to move into the haven and not have to mow the lawn and take care of things and change the storm windows and worry about money. And that begins the battle, and then the family gets involved and says, this woman, the grandmother, is becoming ill, and they say, she's ill because she's so unpleasant. We have to quit there. She's ill because she's so unpleasant. She's her poor spirit for living. And then, of course, it turns out she's ill because she has cancer and has a wonderful spirit for living. So I recommend you tell me a riddle. You must read it sometime. Thank you very much.